This is a podcast for Functional Ecology at British Ecological Society publication.
Hello, I'm Amelia, a publishing assistant for Functional Ecology, and today I have the pleasure of speaking to Ximena Siviles. We're recording this podcast today as Ximena's paper, Silicon and Epichloe Endophyte Defences in a Model Temperate Grass Diminish Feeding Efficiency and Immunity of an Insect Folivore, has been nominated for the Haldane Prize, Functional Ecology's prize for early career researchers. Ximena presented the first report of silicon defences and Epichloe endophyte-derived alkaloids compromising insect immunity via a reduced melanisation response. Ximena, thank you so much for joining me today. Would you like to tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and a bit about your journey in ecology as well?
Hello, my name is Ximena Siviles, and I'm actually originally from Uruguay, South America. And this is where I'm actually working at right now. So even though I was born in South America, after finishing high school, me and my family all moved to America, to the US, where I started my bachelor's degree. So we moved to Iowa. My mom at the time was a PhD student, and that's why we ended up in the States. So I was 19 years old. I started the university here in Uruguay. I knew that I loved entomology, but in Uruguay, entomology is not a career. It's just you start as a biologist and then you specialize. Anyways, my mom told us that the idea was to move as a family to Iowa. And she mentioned the fact that Iowa had a career, a bachelor's degree in entomology. So I was like, I was stoked. I couldn't believe that existed. So luckily I went to a bilingual school. So I had some English background. The first months were hard, but we moved all to Iowa. So I have a brother. I'm the oldest of three, a brother and a sister after me. So we moved to Iowa, and there I started as a biology degree. I didn't start as entomology because I was afraid that it was going to be too specific. And my dream was always to come back to Uruguay and, you know, work here in my hometown. But this is something that I'll come after. Anyways, we moved to Iowa. I started my biology degree, but I took some entomology classes. And I was like more convinced that entomology was what I liked. So after my second semester, I signed up as a double degree in biology and entomology. And I also started working in an entomology lab. Back then, the leader of the lab was Aaron Gassman, and he was working with corn insects, and I loved it. I loved everything about it. He was looking at BT resistance in insects and the interactions between an insect being resistant and its susceptibility to natural enemies. So in shorter words, what he believed was that now it's known is that to develop resistance, insects have to be, there's a cost, and that cost could be making them more susceptible to natural enemies. And that was actually what I worked for in that lab for 4 years during my bachelor's degree. I was very lucky that there was a postdoc at the lab at the time. Her name was Jen Petzold, and Jen kind of like took over me as a mentor. And she explained to me basic science. She gave me tools to start, you know, working on experiments. And then by the time I was finishing my bachelor's degree, I already had a co-authored paper with her, which was tremendous help. And Jen also pushed me into going for, postgraduate work. I, at the time, was thinking of staying in Iowa. But she was, again, an amazing person, an amazing friend. And she was like, well, you are here in Iowa. You took advantage of this for the 4 years. I think what you should do is to move on and try another state or try another lab. And we decided that the program in North Carolina and or in Kansas were two programs that I really, really liked. And I applied for both, and I ended up moving to Kansas, where I did my master's there, working with canola and insects again. And yeah, so Kansas was an amazing experience too. There I was for 3 years and a half, did my master's, worked on plenty of side projects. My boss in Kansas, Brian McCormack, was an excellent mentor. He was excellent in the field. He was very promoting. He was always promoting us for, doing our own ideas, looking for our own hypotheses, working on our scientific methods. So it was really, really cool experience. And by the time the 3 years were done, me and Brian were thinking of maybe starting a PhD with him and staying in Kansas. But at that time, my family was back home in Uruguay. And, as I said before, my dream was always to go back to Uruguay. And I wasn't sure if I wanted to stay in America, go back to Uruguay, do a PhD. Like, all these things were in my mind. So I decided to apply for a job here in South America before, before accepting a PhD offer. And well, in 2000, this is 2014. 2014, I came back to Uruguay, and my first job was with forest pests and biocontrol. I loved it. It was a small team of entomologists, all young scientists, still my colleagues. It was in the north part of Uruguay. Uruguay is a very, very small country in South America, but it was closer than America for me than the States. So I started my job. It was for a 2 year contract, and it was perfect because I had 2 years to try in Uruguay, and then I could, go back to America for a PhD, look for a PhD somewhere else. Who knew? But I was able to try and then see. So moved to Uruguay, started my job, and after 6 months in my job, the position where I'm at opened. And this position was in my hometown, in field entomology, which is what I studied. So soybean, canola, forage crops, not trees. And it was also a permanent position. So I didn't hesitate it. I was like, this is where what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna apply and then I'll see what happens. So I applied and I got it. And I was really, really happy. Moved back to my hometown. Loved the first years that I was in the job here. There's a lot of things to do in Uruguay, and there's not many entomologists. Many unknown things because as there's not many scientists, so there's more things to actually unravel. So came back to my hometown, started this job, and got married with my high school sweetheart, which all the way through America experience, he was still in Uruguay and I was in America. We kept seeing each other. So got married with him, and after 3 years and a half at this position, my boss was like, I think it's time for you to start thinking of a PhD. And there was two options: or I stayed in Uruguay and I did my PhD here, or I left somewhere else and got experience abroad. And of course, the second one was the most challenging, but I was not that afraid because I already lived in Iowa. And that's where I started thinking of what I wanted as a PhD student. What were the areas that I needed to work more on? And what I felt less secure about was my writing. Writing was something that always got me very scared. It was never, never, it's never, it was never good enough. Still a little bit of imposter syndrome still with me, but working on it. But at the time I wrote a paper and I had to read it like 100 times before it was ready for anybody to see it. So I started looking for professors that had profiles of good mentors in writing. And of course, how would you see that is how much papers do their students publish? And I came across a program in Australia. That Australia was a country that me and Juan, my husband, visited but never thought about living. And well, I emailed Scott Johnson, who is in HIE, the Hawkesbury Institute for the Environment. And Scott gave me time for a Zoom meeting. And after what, like 4 6 months, we applied for funding and I got funding and I moved to Australia. So there I was in Australia, starting a PhD, but now working with Uruguayan germplasm. So the whole point of my Australia experience is that I was employed by Uruguay. So it was going somewhere abroad, but bringing an idea that was from Uruguay, which maybe for some people that's a little bit overwhelming, but for me it was like the perfect combination because I could actually, specialize in something that actually would help me come back to Uruguay and still work somewhere else. So I started my PhD project with fescue as a model plant, which is grown all over the world as a pasture crop. And I got seeds from Uruguay and used them in Australia. And of course, in one of the lines that Scott was, well, one of Scott's strongest line in Australia is the working with silicon. So silicon is a metalloid that is in the field, in the soil, sorry, and plants absorb it and become more physically defended against insects. So my whole PhD started on that idea. And well, after 3 years and a half, finished, came back to Uruguay, and now I'm here again.
We're recording this podcast as part of the Haldane Prize, Functional Ecology's prize for early career researchers. And your research, which was published in 2023, has been shortlisted for this prize. Could you, well, first of all, congratulations.
Thank
Could you
you.
tell us a little bit about this research and the questions you were seeking to find answers to?
Sure. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I was very happy and honored to get the email from you guys. And this is my first podcast, so I'm also excited, nervous, and happy to do this as well. When I first contacted Scott in Australia, we didn't really he didn't even he didn't really had a project in mind. He had a line developed in silicon, so silicon research, and specifically silicon and interactions with biotic stress, sometimes with abiotic stress. So he had some with drought, for example, always involving insects. Scott is an ecologist and he works mostly with entomology. I say that I study entomology, but I think most of my projects end up being ecology related. So I love the ecology within the entomology interactions, I guess. So back then, when I was in Uruguay before doing my PhD, I was actually working with fescue and endophytes. Endophytes are this fungi that live inside the foliar of the grasses, and they are symbionts. So with this, the plant actually takes up on the endophytes, and the endophytes survive inside them, with the benefit of them protecting the plant. So many grasses don't have specialized chemicals to protect themselves against insect pests, for example. So, for example, glucosinolates in brassica, they respond to damage. Grasses don't have that. So some of these grasses associate with this and that endophytes, which in exchange for carbon, they produce compounds that are nitrogen rich, like alkaloids, and they actually protect the plant from the stress, in this case, insects. So I was working with that model system with some grasses that actually are from Uruguay. So in Uruguay, I was working with that model system where I used fescue as a forage grass, and I used these endophytes as natural defenses or natural symbionts that help them defend themselves against insects. So when we first talked with Scott, I didn't even know about the existence of silicon. For me, I studied back in high school or in the at the beginning of my career that silicon was a physical defense against insects, but I didn't really knew much about anything, any of the silicon world. So when we first talked with Scott, he mentioned a paper, which was a paper by Sue Hartley. Actually, Hewitt was a student of Sue Hartley that published a paper that they reported that in the field, plants that have endophytes had higher silicon concentrations. And this is was an experiment done for something else. They did not apply silicon on the plants. They just measured silicon and saw that. And that was actually the basis of my thesis, my PhD thesis. So there was evidence from the field that plants with endophytes, I think they were ryegrass plants, no, they were meadow fescue. These plants that had these endophytes that were from the same genus had more silicon than the sister plants that were the same age and were grown in the same field. So we started thinking of hypotheses of why this would happen. And that's how my PhD work started. On my first chapter, what we did is we grew plants with and without silicon in hydroponic solution. So if we come back to the beginning of my talk, we know that silicon is in all soils. So the only way of excluding silicon from a system is by growing plants hydroponically. So on this first experiment, we did with and without silicon and without endophytes. I have seed that I know that is endophyte free and endophyte infected, and they're the same exact isolines. So exactly the same, but with endophytes or without. So in that paper, we demonstrated that regardless of what endophyte the fescue has, it could be, I think we used two strains. We also tried it with fescue. With ryegrass, regardless of what strain of endophyte the plant has, when there was an endophyte, there was higher amount of silicon in tissue. So something was going on, and now of course you want that hypothesis to be that direction, right? Because then we started thinking a grass that has higher silicon has higher physical defense, and a grass that has more endophyte. Or if silicon does not actually affect the endophyte, this grass has both physical and chemical defenses. So that's how the PhD started, I guess. Of course, the other chapters were more about specific insects and how this relationship happened. And the second to last chapter of my thesis is the one that we are actually talking about today. In this one, it was a really cool experiment in where what we wanted to know is that we knew that silicon affected chewing insects, right? So physical defense, it's kind of like the grass is filled with sand, and then when the insects that chew on it, their mandibles are degraded, and therefore they stop eating, therefore they stop gaining weight, therefore they die. We also knew that the chemical defenses of the endophyte are stronger when it comes to phloem feeding insects, kind of like aphids, because the actual chemical defenses are in the phloem. But what we didn't know is what happened with the immunity of the chewing herbivores. So sometimes they don't die, they stop eating, and we wanted to know, kind of coming back again to that first experiment I had in Iowa, what happens with the immunity of an insect if it feeds on a plant that is physically defended. And our hypothesis was that that caterpillar, if it survives, it's going to be more susceptible to its natural enemies. And that's where this experiment came to the place. So HIE or Western Sydney has an intern program where you can actually apply for funding. And if they like your idea, if a student picks your idea, you get like the opportunity to mentor an intern. And actually, John is not an author in the paper because he stopped after he graduated. He stopped and he was not interested in being part of the paper, but he's in acknowledgments. But I was very, very lucky that I presented this idea, and this kid, John, was really, really excited about it. And he and I started this experiment in where we first grew all the plants with and without endophytes, with and without silicon in hydroponics for a couple of weeks. Then we left some plants with and without caterpillars. So kind of like what happens with a plant when there's no herbivore versus when there is. And then of course, we actually looked at the caterpillar. What happened with it? How does that caterpillar grew? What happened to its mandibles? And then what happens to its immunity? And it was a really cool experiment because what we didn't use natural enemies. So we didn't actually use the wasp, for example, for the caterpillar. What we did is we pinched some caterpillars with a nylon filament. And that's actually kind of like simulating the ovipositor of a wasp. Then we pinched another group and we left the nylon filament in. And that's kind of like, one of them was just to see if only the pinching was enough to stimulate an immunity response, versus the other one was what happens if it's a sustained infection, kind of like then what happens naturally. And then we had a group of caterpillars that we didn't do anything to. And we were very surprised to see that even though the two things didn't actually, the caterpillar didn't, the immunity didn't respond to the two things together, there was a response for both. So the silicon did not directly affect the immunity, but it did when the caterpillar was feeding on endophytic plants. There was an incremental immunity response than when the caterpillars were feeding on endophyte free plants. What we think is that the alkaloids, there's kind of an interaction with the alkaloids and the physical damage as well. And that's why we see caterpillars that are more susceptible to natural enemies when they eat plants that have both the chemical from the endophyte and the physical defense from the silicon. So it was quite cool.
Why do you think this research is so important? And what do you think the broader impacts are, both for ecology, but also for maybe policy implications?
Well, I think that in a world where we know that most of the tools that we have to protect our plants from insects are chemicals that are lethal to not only us, but to life, exploring any kind of natural interactions is important. When I was writing my thesis, one very cool thing that stuck in my mind was that when we breed plants for our food, we kind of like separate them from their natural defenses. There's always a cost, you know, when the plant has to grow and to protect themselves. When we select plants to have better yield, we know now from other researchers that have published papers on this subject that we make plants lose the connection with these natural defenses. So I think that exploring how these natural defenses occur in nature is a very fascinating thing. And one thing that happened in my PhD is that I studied for a long time only endophytes. But if you only study endophytes, you lose what happens with the endophytes in the natural setting when the endophyte is actually interacting with other natural things that are actually making the plant also stronger for other things. So when I was thinking of my PhD, me and Scott had a lot of discussions, and we really wanted to, even though we did experiments in the lab, we wanted to look at complex interactions. So we know that endophytes and silicon are interacting in nature, but there was no papers at that time of experiments actually, designed to look at those interactions. So it was very fascinating to like start looking at like complex interactions and seeing how one thing can actually, you know, alter the rest. On my last chapter of the thesis, I also added AMF, so mycorrhizae. So it's always mycorrhizae is also Adam Frew, a student from Scott, was actually looking at, before me, was actually looking at interactions between AMF and silicon. And he also knew, he also reported that AMF, the presence of AMF increased silicon concentrations. So another beneficial fungi that is actually interacting positively with silicon. So I guess to make things short, I think it's always important to have, to know how chemicals work. How synthetic chemicals work. They are an important tool in our management programs, but understanding the natural associations of plants and their relationships with this, you know, biotic community that is actually helping them be more defended is actually fascinating for me. So After my PhD was done, now I can say that, you know, a fescue plant that has no endophyte has no chemical protection. And if you add the endophyte on the germplasm, which you can actually buy seeds that have endophytes, these seeds are more protected with the endophyte, with chemical defenses. And now we can also say that if you actually apply silicon in the field, you actually have a stronger plant that has another kind of protection that is physical, that is actually also making the plant more tolerant to like abiotic and biotic stress. So I think that's by looking at these complex interactions, you can actually start disentangling all these cool things that are happening in nature, and I don't know, maybe start applying this like more natural techniques into our systems. Of course, when there's an outbreak, sometimes these are not enough. But I think, you know, it's a good avenue to explore these things, because maybe we're reaching there. We still don't know how to incorporate these natural techniques as well in the field. But, you know, knowledge is everything. Once you know your system, you can actually apply it. So I guess that's what my PhD journey gave me.
You speak very, very fondly about this research, and it's clear that you enjoyed doing it. But was there anything particularly challenging about conducting this research, maybe collecting your data? And was there anything about your results that you found particularly surprising?
Yes, of course. There was a lot of things that didn't work out as good as I am now talking in my PhD. Actually, one chapter of my thesis was going to be in Adelaide, in the Adelaide Phenomic Facility, where I was going to work with white grubs, and grubs are, you know, insects that feed on the root. And for a year, we were trying to collect them in the field and we couldn't. So, this happens all the time. And I think for my PhD, that last chapter needed to change. And actually, I couldn't even go to Adelaide until the end. So I couldn't put in my PhD, that experiment. So COVID in the middle, not being able to go to the lab as much or the field, forced me to, I guess, like simplify some of my experiments at the end. But also COVID gave me, I'm very enthusiastic and I'm always trying new ideas. I love being in the lab. And I think it could be a negative part. Like, you know, kind of like I'm always eager to do the experiment, but I'm always at the time I'm better now. I'm afraid of writing. So I guess COVID forced me to stay at my house and write, and also stay at my house and run the models for these experiments. These are very complex experiments. Many, many hours of R. I didn't have any knowledge in R. So my co-advisor was Jeff Powell. He's actually an ecologist in HIE that is also, he teaches the R course. So I was very lucky to have him in my committee, and he gave me a lot of advice. But hours and hours, I guess design of the experiments, I was lucky that it worked. We designed them and the experiments worked. Of course, not all the results were what we expected, but we were lucky enough that we could find bibliography to back up both avenues. But I guess like the most time-consuming or hardworking part of the PhD was the analyzing part and the writing part, which, you know, I still have one paper that is now in under review for my PhD, and I graduated in 2022. So, you know, it's fun to run the experiments, but you know, the writing part is the challenging part, and it's also the part where you actually have to sit down and ask questions. You know, was this what we expected? Why wasn't it like what we expected? I was very lucky to be in a team, in Scott's team. Scott had at the time, we were five PhD students that started all very almost at the same time. Actually, two of them, Tariq and Rocky, are authors in this paper. So, Putra and Islam are two PhD students in my lab. I was really lucky in the sense that it was a group of five of us, all related to silicon and insect work. So we had a lot of discussions, heated discussions, of course, because sometimes, you know, you didn't believe, or your posture was not the same as the other. But it was a very cool environment. We were able to work very good together, and I think it's seen because we all published quite well from our PhDs, and we all became more secure of our point, at least our viewpoints. Doesn't mean that you're always right, but at least you can actually, you know, be more secure about yourself.
We spoke a little bit earlier. I know that you've just been out in the field doing some work. Have you continued along the lines of this research, or are you working on something completely new? What is it that you're doing at the moment?
Yes and yes, I guess. So back home, I work in INIA, which is the National Institute of Agricultural Science in Uruguay. I also teach at the uni, but it's a very small portion of my time. My research station is not in the capital city. It's not in my hometown, which is like 2 hours away from the capital city, but it's the biggest research station of field crops in Uruguay. When I say field crops, I say pasture and also extensive crops, so like soybean, maize, etc., canola. So when I came back from Australia, I took my position as the leader of the entomology team. So before that, there was a senior scientist that retired while I was in Australia. So I took over and I had both programs, the crops and the pastures. So of course, for the crops, I have lines such as, you know, testing biological control, testing, no, monitoring biological control in different crops. I absolutely love anything that has to do with natural control. It could be through chemical ecology or through, you know, predators or whatever. We also do some insecticide testing, but what we do is mostly, what my premise is I don't want to test something that is already in the market. I want something that is new, that is actually more sustainable, and it's more green. So the world is going that way. So I do a lot of testing products with industry, but products that are actually, need more developing, or there's nothing known. The initial stages. We also do a lot of host plant interactions. So, for example, I came back from my PhD in 2022, and there was a giant outbreak of the sugarcane aphid in sorghum. So the sugarcane aphid is a huge pest that destroyed sorghum in America in 2013, and now it's, America, US, and now it's down here in Uruguay. So my program has been looking for hybrids that have resistance to this pest. So we try not only to, do some lab and field assays, but also molecular work to see, the hybrids that have better, behavior. What is it that they have that make them better? So that's mostly what I do with field crops. Lots of soybean research as well. Soybean is the biggest commodity crop in Uruguay. So I work with stink bugs and alternatives to insecticides. And so that would be more for the field crops. For the pastures, I was very, very lucky that when I came back for my PhD, we applied to funding from a national agency. So it's called the ANI, the National Agency for Research and Innovation here. So I applied for a project in where Scott, so my former advisor in HIE Australia, and we also paired up with Jonathan Grassfold in Max Planck in Germany. So we applied for funding to keep working with silicon endophytes and interactions. But in this time, so taking these things that I was doing in the lab to the field. So we were very lucky that we got funding for this. So in 2022, I learned that I got funding. Took almost a year to, sign all the paperwork and start, the program going. And this year, at the middle of March, I get a postdoc and a PhD to start with me on that project. So I'm hoping to keep going with the line of endophyte silicon interactions in real field situations here in Uruguay. Of course, tagging along collaborations with Scott and with Jonathan in Germany now.
So, Hirana, we've talked a little bit about how you got into ecology and how you sort of first started out. What do you feel, if any, have been the major barriers to, in your scientific career, and how have you overcome them? I know you've talked a little bit about how you sort of have felt imposter syndrome and how you struggled with writing. How did you overcome these?
First of all, I think I intentionally looked for a PhD that was going to challenge me on the thing that I was most afraid of. I think that's how I am. I like challenges, and I am humble about the things that I'm not good at. And I think that's partially why I got so many good things out of all my experiences. And I was very lucky to find very good mentors in the middle, mostly in Iowa, where I started. 19-year-old girl coming from Uruguay, Spanish, Latina, and also, not native to America. I was minority back then, and I think I was very lucky that I had people that believed in me and like, oversaw that part and gave me, I don't know, the instruments to actually go to conferences and, have my own projects. And then I think, yeah, I think, yeah, just, being not afraid of knowing what I'm not good at and trying to be better at it. Of course, writing is still challenging for me. I still, it's still for me the hardest part in science. Of course, you get better as you start doing it, but yeah. One thing, when I was almost finishing my PhD during the COVID pandemic, I learned about a course that is called Mindful Writing. Her name is Ana Piñeda. So she's a Spanish lady that did a PhD and a postdoc. And I guess she told us that she had the imposter syndrome, and she always felt that she was never good enough to write. Well, the thing is that she actually developed this, I think it was a 6 weeks course. No, it was a 5 week course, online course that taught you how to write more mindfully. And I think for me, that was a great experience. Actually, I think in my acknowledgments in this paper, I actually acknowledge her and the program. So what you do in that course is that literally, like, you meet once a week, and she gives you tools not to write better, but to know yourself when to write better, how to write better, and when to not make yourself write. And that, I think that was key. Like, I sat down and I spent hours and hours not writing, becoming first frustrated, and that made me more frustrated and made me write less. And I feel like I couldn't progress. And her course gave me like tools to know when I had to like stand up and, you know, take a breath, or when there was a good day to, I don't know, to make a figure and, you know, not write, when like feel your inspiration, I guess. So I think I would strongly recommend people to take that. It was really good for me. She also incorporates yoga into her writing. So I think like, she gave me tools that made me at least more aware of how to be, you know, more supportive to myself, I guess. but yeah. And yeah, I think that's the main point. Of course, you know, you always wonder what would have happened if I stayed in Iowa, what would have happened if I didn't come back to Uruguay. I don't know, many, many things, but I think even if you are a minority, you should just, you know, go straight for your goals and try it, because you never know what you're gonna, you know, end up with. So yeah.
That feeds really well onto my final two questions for you today.
Mm-hmm.
So the first of these is, outside of ecology, what do you enjoy doing? What are your hobbies? What do you like doing in your spare time? And yeah, what do you do to wind down from
mm-hmm.
all of the research papers you must be working on?
family is very important to me. And that was the main reason why Uruguay was always, you know, a point to come back to. I know that South America science, in South America, science is not as developed. We don't have the money or the funding that other countries have. But I think that family was always missing. Actually, when I went for my undergrad, I had my family in Iowa. So I think that's partially the reason why I went. I don't think I would have gone by myself, to be honest, but who knows? My master's was by myself, yes. But I had my boyfriend at the time, who's now my husband, that every day we called each other. At that time, there was no Skype. Well, there was Skype, sorry. There was no WhatsApp, so it was Skype. And every day we talked to each other, and he was like my emotional support back then. And that's probably the reason why for my PhD, you know, it was with Juan, going with Juan or not going anywhere. And he was actually very supportive, and he wanted to, you know, try the experience abroad and learn new cultures, etc. So we went together to Australia. But yeah, I think family pulls a lot. And I love, absolutely love animals. So I now have, I don't have, my house is outside the city. It's a very small city, like 30,000 people. And I have like 4 hectares, and I have 4 dogs, chickens, cats. I love everything about, like, you know, having animals. And I think for my hobby, what I mostly do is I love reading, but I think my favorite activity is to go like to the beach. So we are in the coast, in a city in the coast. So we go to the river and we with Juan, my husband, and my dogs, and we walk in the beach. So I think that's my, favorite activity. So I think, a lot of people ask me why didn't I stay in the countries that I studied, and I think that's the main reason. I think science would not complete me if I didn't have the other part, and I think I would never, regret that.
And finally, Jimena, if you could give early career researchers one piece of advice, what would it be?
I think it's don't be afraid. Don't be afraid to, if you see a scholarship, apply to it. Don't be afraid because in my case, because I'm female, because I'm Latin American, because whatever. It doesn't matter what it is. Just go for it. Go for it because I think, sometimes you think you're not good enough, and the reality is that you never know. You never know until you try. And I think trying, I guess trying is what's important. Failing is not the only thing that matters. I did it, I tried for it, I didn't get it. And then I think it's also learning from failures. So why is it that I didn't get it? How can I improve? What is it that I needed more? Things like that. And then my second piece of advice is don't be afraid of saying what you think. Because a lot of the times you have a professor that is in front of you and he's your idol in science, and you're like, oh my God, I'm talking to this person. That was Scott was kind of like for me like that. He's like, he writes a million papers a year, and I'm like here and I'm giving him my first manuscript. And you know what? There's people behind those persons. And a lot of the times they're good mentors. So, sometimes a stupid idea is a great idea if you are actually in a group that can, think of how to get it into, a nice objective or whatever. So I guess I was never afraid of saying what I think. And I think that's something that I would love everybody that is around me, my students or people that are around me to not be afraid of to say what they think, because sometimes, you never know. Maybe they didn't think about it, or I don't know, they didn't come across with it. So that, and also interacting with people from other areas. I think HIE made me realize H so I was in America, I was always surrounded by entomologists. When I moved to Australia, there were people from all over the world and all over the place. Like, there were people studying. I have friends that study songbirds and friends that study bats. And then, my crisis and talking to these people and realizing that, the scientific framework is there, even though our organisms or our models are not the same. It's fascinating. So I think it's, don't be afraid of, sharing your ideas. And interacting with people that are in areas that you're not, sure of, or you're not an expert on. I think you learn from all of those experiences.
Jimena, thank you so much for talking to me today. It's been a real pleasure, and congratulations on your shortlisted paper.
Thank you very much for your time. Thank you. Bye bye.